Call 815-223-3093 to talk it over with John Small on WLPO, your voice of the valley.
AM 1220 WLPO on this Sunday morning. A little bit of music to, if you're just still rolling out of bed, because, hey, it's Sunday. People have different schedules. Some are going off to work. Others have the whole day to themselves. And maybe you're recovering from an early Super Bowl party or something like that. I don't know. Well, welcome in to AM 1220 WLPO. Glad to have you here. And I got to ask our guest, Roger McBride. He's written a book, and it's in association with National Geographic, Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. And Roger McBride Allen is his full name, also helped out by Thomas B. Allen. I got to ask, as Roger joins us here on AM 1220 WLPO, Roger, I am a huge fan of the original Wild, Wild West, and I'm just wondering, are there any elements in Mr. Lincoln's time that might have, you know, been a part of the Wild Wild West TV show? Is there anything that they have in common? Was Abraham Lincoln actually messing with the kind of technology that we'd see on that TV show?
Well, of course, that was a all-made-up show. They were having a lot of fun and putting in things that no one had thought of for decades, until decades later. But Lincoln was very, very interested in technology. One of the things he did quite often was to go down to the Washington Navy Yard and participate in weapons tests of one sort or another. He would, when a new gun was invented, he'd actually sometimes go down and pull the trigger himself, and he'd observe firing exercises. He had a balloonist suspend himself over the mall in Washington, D.C., and send the first telegraph message from the middle of the air to him, and then took him to dinner that evening and had him stay at the White House while the balloon was floating between the White House and the Washington Monument.
So this is maybe, is this the start of what you might call the high-tech era? I mean, obviously, it's in its infancy and quite still underdeveloped, but I mean, it sounded like, I mean, these guys were, you know, at that time, messing with stuff that was out on the fringe, if you will. I mean, they were experimenting with stuff that would, you know, take shape later in the future.
Well, to a very great degree, that was true, but it was also true. What really happened was that this was the first war since the invention of an efficient railroad, since the invention of fully capable telegraphs and so on. It was the first war where mass production really played a role in being able to crank out thousands and thousands and thousands of weapons and so on. So a lot of what went on in the high-tech Civil War was they took advantage of very recent inventions for the first time in warfare. One of the things I'd like to say is that this was the first war that the soldiers didn't have to walk to the battlefield.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was still a lot of marching. There were still a lot of people had to walk a long way.
Horses, too.
I'm sorry?
Horses, too, probably.
Oh, absolutely. You would ride a horse if you were an officer, or you would walk if you were a soldier, but you could get on a train and be transported hundreds of miles, perhaps even thousands of miles, to where you were needed in a couple of days. And once you were there, you were rested. You had your supplies have been brought in also by rail. You could get very close to the battlefield before you started having to carry everything, and you could bring a lot more equipment.
So we're seeing some similarities between the warfare that's conducted today and that occurred back in 1860, but obviously you have to account for time and so forth and so on. But if you're being transported in a couple of days by train, I mean, that was a remarkable change and quite a surprise, I'm sure, to the soldiers who were used to either walking or being on horseback.
Absolutely. One of the things that's often said is that the Civil War, by causing so many people to travel so far during the war, was one of the things that made people think of the United States as one country rather than a collection of states. If you had lived in Massachusetts all your life and never left Massachusetts, Ohio didn't seem to matter to you, or Virginia or Washington, D.C. But if you had traveled there, if you had been there, if you had seen the same flag flying over those places as flew at home, you would think of it as your place.
Roger McBride Allen and also Thomas B. Allen have written a book called Mr. Lincoln's High Tech War. We're talking to Roger McBride Allen right now on AM 1220. WLPO, and if you want to say hi, I have a quick question, 223-3093. Be glad to make it a three-way call. No problem. I'm just wondering, Mr. Allen, you're saying that all these things were available to Lincoln. Was Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, was he at a distinct disadvantage? Did he have any of these things going for him as well?
He was at a tremendous disadvantage. The North had far and away the vast majority of the industrial capacity of the pre-war United States. But, in a strange way, it wasn't as much of a disadvantage as you think, as the Union side was kind enough to supply both armies. A very large amount of what the Confederacy fought with were weapons they got from the Union in one way or another. They would raid a supply depot and grab the weapons. After a battle, they would go out onto the battlefield and pick up the rifled muskets of the dead soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They were constantly gleaning, if you will, weapons from the other side. It wasn't just rifles, it was uniforms, it was shoes, it was whatever they could get their hands on.
So again, in that situation, then they started maybe use those weapons against the North, and you know, we have the same problem nowadays too. If we lose an aircraft among all the enemy has use of that technology, and hopefully they can't make use of it, but they can study it anyway. The same thing that goes on today, where we lose technology to the enemy, was happening back then during the Civil War, am I right?
Yes, but they had it worse because Jefferson Davis was the Secretary of War who approved the use of the what became the standard-issue musket for both sides.
Hmm.
He was the Secretary of War before the Civil War, and he was deeply involved in deciding which weapons to use. One of the big things that happened that you can make a case it never happened before or since is that the Southern Army, the Confederate Army, the officer corps was made up in very large measure by people who had gone to West Point, who knew the guys in the Northern Army, were friends of theirs, who they knew all the ways the Army operated. They knew all the tactics. They knew all the people. They had a tremendous amount of information about the Union Army because they had been in it.
So, Civil War, I mean, from what you're describing then, it was a really pretty strange situation. I mean, in a number of different ways, a nation fighting with itself, and you, because of political philosophy and some of the issues of the day, people who were friends and had access to a lot of education end up splitting up and fighting against each other, more or less. I mean, it was kind of a strange situation, the way you explain it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things I think is Americans don't really register is that we had a very unusual Civil War, in that mostly a Civil War is everybody on both sides, or two or three sides if you're really in bad shape, all mixed up together. The people on one side might be living next door in the next town or two doors down from the people on the other side, that you would really be at each other's throat constantly. It was very unusual for a Civil War to be, if you will, so neat geographically, that there was the South, there was the North. And in reality, of course, it wasn't quite that neat. There was quite a few disputes in between. But our Civil War was geographically based, and almost everyone else's was all over the place. The English Civil War, for example, was almost town by town.
Roger McBride Allen has written Mr. Lincoln's High Tech War is with us here on AM 1220 WLPO. Were there any weapons
I want to give my dad, Thomas B. Allen, much credit as I can. He was. We had a great time writing it together, and we wrote it together.
Okay. I won't leave him out next time, that's for sure. Was there anything, Mr. Allen, that Lincoln saw that he disapproved of? Were there, you know, did he have a social conscience, if you will, saying don't use that weapon? Or was there anything like that at work at that time?
That's a very interesting and difficult question. And one of the things the Civil War was a war of attrition, where basically whoever, you would kill the other guy's soldiers, and he would kill yours, and whoever was left with some soldiers left over when the killing was done would win. One of the North's tremendous advantages was that it had more men. And it, for various reasons, it was able to continuously recruit more men. It actually had had a larger pool of possible recruits at the end of the war than it did at the beginning. The Confederacy did not. And there was various decisions that were almost the opposite of what you described, where it was decided to accept the cruelty because it would make the war shorter, because, for example, they used to exchange prisoners. So that if you were a Confederate captured in battle, they would wait until a Union officer of comparable rank was captured, and they would swap the two of you, and each of you go back to your own army. Or you might not even be in prison. You would simply give your parole, your oath, your promise that you would not fight until you were exchanged in this way. But since the Confederacy had many fewer men than the North, this system of exchanges was tremendously to the Confederate advantage. It was returning men to the battlefield, and each man returned was a larger proportion of the Confederate army than would be the case for the Northern Army. This is one of the big reasons that they decided to not exchange prisoners, and that they had prisoner of war camps. They had never had prisoner of war camps. Neither side was very good at it. There was tremendous cruelty and awful suffering and horrible conditions at the camps north and south, the most famous being Andersonville, but some of the in the south, but some of the northern camps weren't so great. But if a man was being kept in a southern prison by the Confederacy, that meant there was a northern prison that was holding a southern man who could not go back to the war. Every man that stayed in that prison, the theory went, and there's probably a lot of argument to say this is true, shortened the war. So it was a case of Lincoln and the North deliberately accepting a smaller, briefer cruelty in the hope that came true that it would shorten the war. And anything that shortens the war is to the good.
Well, it's not really... It's not really a black and white issue, no pun intended. I mean, there's always some conflict. I mean, it's a gray area, more or less, is what you're trying to say in regards to accepting some short-term pain for hopefully, you know, a quicker end to the war. I'm intrigued here by the title, too, on the front cover here, Surveillance Balloons. Were they flying overhead over the enemy and trying to spy on him? How did they use surveillance balloons necessarily?
Well, that was precisely it. Again, the North did this a lot more than the South. the South did some of it and had rather bad luck. Surveillance balloons were sent up from not too far back from the front lines on the Union side. They'd go up possibly even a couple of miles, more typically maybe a few thousand feet, and they'd be able to observe the battlefield. This mostly happened in the first part of the war. My belief is that one of the reasons it didn't happen later on in the war is the guys who did this lost battles. And so they were doing something new and newfangled and untraditional, and they were losing. Therefore, their successors, the Union officers, the Union generals who took over, didn't want to get involved in the same sort of newfangled gimmickry that they've gotten their predecessors into trouble. But for the first couple of years of the war, there were surveillance balloons, and
let me ask you real quick.
They were of tremendous value.
I'm just curious. I mean, it's a stupid question to ask. I'm sure it was extremely hazardous, but do you have any kind of any historical records to reveal just how hazardous was it? I mean, did they lose a lot of these surveillance balloons, or were the guys from the South really bad shots? I mean, how hazardous was this kind of work, being up in a surveillance balloon?
Not a single surveillance balloon was shot down.
Really?
And that is always the first question anyone asks about that. And we researched this point, and other researchers have gone over this point. You inventoried the balloons after the war, and there they all were. They definitely weren't shot down. This gets more or less into a question of ballistics, but when you're shooting a rifle at something, if you're even shooting the bullet level, the bullet will continue to drop as it travels.
Okay.
If you're aiming that bullet up in the air, it's going to do a parabolic arc, not a straight line. And if you're aiming at something 1,000 feet up in the air, a half a mile away, it's almost impossible to judge that shot.
Yeah. High-powered. Go ahead. Go ahead and finish. I didn't mean to interrupt. Did you want to finish a thought there?
No, please go ahead.
High-powered weapons, too, right here on the cover of the book. Rifles, cannons. I mean, how high-powered are we talking about, these high-powered weapons?
Well, the rifled musket, the weapon that every soldier pretty much put on a shoulder and marched off with was tremendously more powerful than what had been in use even a few years before. The smoothbore flintlock, and without going to explaining all the differences, briefly put, almost all the officers in this in the Confederacy and in the Union Army had fought on the same side in the Mexican War about 20 years earlier, and that war had been fought with smoothbore muskets.
Mm-hmm.
And Grant was there in the Mexican War, and he said at one point, someone could shoot at you with a smoothbore from 200 yards away all day long, and you'd never find it out. They were really very inaccurate and had a very short range, and they took a long time to load.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they got to the Civil War, they were using a rifled musket, and they were using a different method of firing the gun called a percussion cap system. And this meant that the gun could shoot maybe two or three times as far, perhaps with two or three times the accuracy, and could be fired more rapidly. And all of a sudden, everyone had the tactics. They were used to a gun that they were safe until they were 200 yards away. Now, half a mile away, they might not be safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys shooting at them could shoot more accurately and shoot faster. All their assumptions about tactics and so forth went out the window. All of a sudden, they were up against something that was far more lethal. Something about 90% of the casualties in the Civil War were caused by rifle muskets.
Hmm.
They also were doing more powerful cannons, various sizes, and those were certainly used for a lot of attacks, a lot of bashing down forts, attacking armies in the field. But the rifled musket was the super weapon of the Civil War in many ways.
This is Roger McBride Allen, who along with Thomas B. Allen has written Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. The National Geographic label's up on top here, so is there a TV special coming, or do we miss out on one? Is there one we can get a DVD copy of? Is there going to be a tie-in to television somewhere along the line there, Mr. Allen?
That sounds like a great idea to me. We've made that suggestion a time or two. Well, maybe someone will hear it sooner or later. At this point, there simply is the book. However, I would mention that we have put together, I think, a pretty extensive website, MrLincolnsHighTechWar.com, which has a tremendous amount of material in it. You can also get to that website with just HighTechCivilWar.com. Either one will get you there.
Nope.
But unfortunately, no movie or TV deal yet, but if I find out about it, I'll let you know.
Sure. And I would imagine, since you probably do fall yourself under the National Geographic Society, you're a member in good standing and all that stuff.
Well, my dad started work at the National Geographic, I guess, in 1965, and mm-hmm. he worked in the book division there all the time growing up, and I would remember going to visit headquarters to see Daddy at work and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Dad has gone freelance, and he's writing on many different subjects, but he's been involved with the National Geographic, you know, since I was a little kid, and obviously the involvement continues.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we've been a member of the club for a long time.
And this book obviously be available in, you know, all the good bookstores and online, too.
Absolutely. Again, if you visit the website, there are links on how to order it, but anywhere online or a good bookstore will certainly have it.
And this is covering the Civil War, and this is by, you know, railroad. There was even, you know, warfare out there on the ocean, too. And in closing here, Mr. McBride, I mean, predominantly the war was on land, right? I mean, how much what was fought in the ocean, what did it really have that much bearing on the actual war itself, what was fought in the ocean?
The Navy was not the most important part of this fight, but the Navy was a tremendously important part of the fight in several ways. Perhaps the most important, the Union Navy enforced the blockade on the South, and that meant that the South had tremendous difficulty importing the things it needed, and it needed practically everything. It could export cotton and agricultural foodstuffs, and that to a decreasing amount as the war went on, because they were running out of things for themselves, and they had to import practically everything else, so that there were blockade runners trying to get back and forth to ship these goods. The Union Navy was the cork in the bottle, keeping the Confederates from trying to get out. The battle between the Monitor and what is sometimes called the Merrimack, but is more properly the Virginia, the first battle between the ironclads. What the Virginia was trying to do was break the blockade and chase the Union ships away from the port at Newport News and therefore allow the Confederacy to trade with the world. And if they managed to break that blockade, we could very well have two countries now. So absolutely, the Navy had a big role. But beyond question, it was a land war. That was a huge part of it.
Again, the website that we should check out, MrLincolnsHighTechWar.com, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, is that with the dash in between the high and the tech, right?
No, all run together.
Okay, all right. Anything else? A sequel coming up to this book, maybe, or too early in the going to tell? Or
there are, in the course of writing this book, I myself, and I know this is true for my father, found a number of wonderful stories that haven't been told, fascinating things that we're not quite ready to step out with yet, but I'm sure there will be some other work that happens as a result of this. In the book business, you never quite know until after the contract is signed, but there's some very promising leads.
All right. Mr. Lincoln's High Tech War is the name of the book, and it's from Thomas B. Allen and this man right here, Roger McBride Allen. I've enjoyed the half hour very much, and Roger, thanks for the visit, and have a good Sunday.
Oh, thank you so much. You as well. I very much enjoyed it.